Did I ask you to do that? First, let's do a mic test. How's the microphone sounding? Okay, good. Thank you, Ryan. First, I use these times here to work out the spirituality that comes up in my academic classrooms, because I cannot do that with my students in the classroom. I can do it in office hours, but I can't. They don't come to office hours. But I use this. And so most of the time, in fact, every time I've been here, it's been a brand new message. I'll get it tuned up here, and then we'll take it on the road. But this is brand new for me. So if I'm a little rough and raw this morning, you'll know why. Second, a word about my parents. Yesterday, I flew to Raleigh and drove them from their house that they've been in since 1972 until yesterday to Greenpoint Village in Greenville, South Carolina. So some of you know that process and that journey, and that's where my parents are. Third thing is, the last time I preached was in a Korean Presbyterian church, where they did a lot of amening, and you go in their own language. So if anybody feels like hallelujah and amen and preach it, sister, I'm a brother, you know, have at it. I'll feel right at home. I don't know about you, but I'll feel right at home. But my goodness, it's good to be back with you. Returning recently from Seoul, Korea, from there, Ron and I hammered back and forth about this morning's topic. And during that process, I came again, once again, that Buddhist truth that nothing stays nailed down. Can I get a witness? And sometimes, as you get that rope burn from clinging too hard from that which you should let go, you may find, if you're lucky, an unhomed fish on the back of a camel, wondering, how in the world did you get so damn thirsty? I wish to make the point this morning that coming to thirst is a good thing. I remember, back in my childhood, and maybe in yours, you go to your religious house, and they ask you what you'd like to be in life. Yes. And growing up in my Southern Baptist-accented places, the most prized choice for us guys were the most religious choices. Becoming a foreign missionary got back slaps from the grown-ups. This is before their high fives. Or a preacher. It was considered a manly business to go out and save the world. For girls, it was being at home with husband and children. That was the prime choice. All other choices for women were hardly vocations. The point remains, for many of us, we want to matter somehow. Some way we want to save the world. And I guess, looking at the ages of people in here, we've all been in someone's pressure cooker or cookie cutter. And there ain't no pressure cooker or cookie cutter like organized religion. Can I get a witness? And the insidious thing is that we probably haven't realized it. A joke to demonstrate. Two young fish are swimming along when they meet a big fish coming the other way. The big fish says, "Hi, how's the water today?" as he's passing by. A little while later, one of the younger fish asks the other, "What the heck is water?" And you know, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir here. The reigning cultures have got us so well trained. Let me roll out a likely scenario for you. You've been here too. Little Mark, little Marcia, what do you want to be in life? But I quickly found out in the religious house that the answer to this question was decoded this way. First, you lay out all your options, whether in your mind or on paper. And then you consider carefully the pros and the cons of each one, their effect upon you, your potential family, your potential earnings. You study them real hard-like. And then you choose. And then you choose the most repugnant one. As if that's where your joys and your God were leading you. As if that's what your God intended. Unpack this process just a little bit, and you had to mix four parts guilt, two parts parental choice, four parts culture, I should do this because somehow it's difficult. Somehow it involves sacrifice. And oh yeah, it'll change the world. I should do this. Really, I should. I must. We should all over ourselves, don't we? The life of shoulds and musts and oughts is hardly a life. Living someone else's life might be righteous, but is it right? How dangerous could you be to me, to others? I'm reminded of a rather negative nursery rhyme for adults by Philip Larkin. This be the verse, if you want to Google it, for I have to censor one word. I'll be using the word mess, but you'll understand. It's a rhyme that gets pulled out by us adults after a drink or two, or when you're in the company of those you trust. Listed by one source as one of the top 100 poems in England. Here it goes. They mess you up, your mom and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. And they fill you with the faults they had and add some extras just for you. But they were messed up in their turn by old fools in old style hats and coats who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Oh, man, hands on misery to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have kids yourself. I mean, ouch. Enough of this. I won't call it conspiracy, but there are pressures to live into another person's projection. And we can end up on any number of levels, in any number of ways, living someone else's life, living someone else's business, cleaning up someone else's mess. And we could all get up here and do our own sermon, like in your bulletin, and we could open mic this morning's message, telling stories about that wrong career, the wrong school, that bad choice, that ill-fated marriage, and the heartache you went through to try to get things right. Maybe you're in that crucible right now. It's time to get off this camel. Maybe some of you here this morning are really, really thirsty, and you know it. Good. Much of my life today is the attempt to bring this very message to 18 to 21-year-olds, God bless them, who are often very dangerous to themselves and to the persons they anticipate becoming. They haven't been schooled right in how to make right choices. This came home to me again a couple of weeks ago, sitting in a coffee shop in Seoul with Ms. Park, and that is her real last name, one of my best students from back in 2012 and 13. Back then, she and I would have almost weekly meetings that turned into sessions about how to manage all those shoulds a young woman has to feel in a most Confucian culture. I won't explain this male-centered ideology and cultural OS, or operating system, except to paraphrase its power in one quote. See that nail? Pound it in before it snags the cultural fabric. Confucian culture, like Southern comfort culture, wears down the individuality of the individual. It's a Procrustean bed. Confucianism, like any other culture, is like sandpaper, filing off the rough edges on a person that may snag on the bars of the cell prepared for you. A word from Dr. Isaac Newton: things at rest tend to stay at rest, and things in motion tend to stay in motion. It's not just true in heavenly bodies, Ms. Park. I think the very reason we were talking together is that you understood Dr. Newton in an autobiographical way. You wanted to break that spiritual inertia. So, Ms. Park, congratulations, and I'm going to send her this message. And congratulations for feeling that dis-ease, for feeling like a fish out of water. Not everyone who dies gets that far. You've come to the mouth of Plato's cave wondering if you can escape the fish farm, the funny farm, that prison So I wonder, my fellow fish, how does one leap off the camel, cross the threshold of the cave, breathe the free air that your idea of God has intended for you? Now let's hear the rest of Dr. Newton's law. Unless operated upon by an external force. So what is that force, Ms. Pock? What is it, UUFH? Two responses. First, looking down, Ms. Pock, you realize that you have in your very hand the key. You are your own warden. The key is just a simple question. Is this all? That could be your thirst. Second, ever been to an AA meeting? I recommend it. Whether you think you need to or not, it's perhaps this culture's only intersection where honesty, vulnerability, and freedom meet. Admitting one's dependency, any dependency, whether cultural or chemical, demands honesty. Admitting requires a ruthless assessment of an enslaved life. Admitting is what happens when you've hit the wall, thirsty for only a satisfying truth. No energy left to pretend. You're done playing games, no longer caring what other people may think of you. You're ready to embrace the truth that you need help. On my visit to AA, I could see, really see for the first time, just how much time and energy and effort I expend just making sure everybody knows pretty damn quickly how strong and smart and quick and competent and capable and together and good I am. Can I get some witnesses? Living into someone else's projected life is a dependency. And oh my God, look at all the strategies we create and the energies we use to declare ourselves normal, declaring in all kinds of ways, I need no help. In my posturing, thirst is the last thing on my mind. To get off the camel's back, we must ask a very straightforward question. Yet how many want to answer it? What is it that you want? What is it that you would pay the highest possible price, endure hardship, overcome any obstacle to acquire? What is it that would get you up thrilled every morning of your life? What would get you that question, is this all, into the mouth and off your tongue as you stand on the threshold? And why are we delaying one more day asking the question? There's a reason why so many personal transformations begin with this question. Is this all there is? It is the dangerous question, because interrupting fish is my day job. It's how I save the world. Many of us, many of my students, have learned quickly how to adapt to what authority figures wanted, how to play the game, somebody else's game with alien rules. And now we may even teach a version of that game. Get that job that pays well. Live that lifestyle that gets people to pay attention to you. Now, living an alienated life can be profitable and can earn us all kinds of accolades and attentions, but are we not enslaved still to the expectations of others? Training to our thirst to be just like everybody else's. I'd like to mention a few people who might be helpful to help us come to a conscious thirst. First, I know some of you have difficulty relating to what our culture calls God. The Buddhist in me does too, but it's with some anxiety that I say that God, however you define God, is right. God gives us desires, heart, passion, love, desires for justice, compassion, organization, order, beauty, knowledge, wisdom. And when we become separated from these holy desires, we lose something. We lose our way. We forget who we are. Buddha is right. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. The mind is everything, he said. What we think, we become. Inside of us, it would seem our usual thoughts are arrhythmic. We are forever restless, dissatisfied, frustrating, aching. We're so overcharged with desire that it's hard to find our simple thirst. Desire in his Pali language is a dukkha, a wheel that has gone out of realm. Think grocery shopping cart with one bad wheel. Are you with me? Anne Frank, Teresa of Lisieux, and Etty Hillesum were right also. There is, they say, within us a fundamental dis-ease, a burning fire that renders us incapable in this life of ever coming to full peace. This desire gets the center of our lives out of round. We are not at ease, human beings who occasionally get restless, serene persons who once in a while are obsessed by desire. The reverse is true. We are driven persons, forever obsessed, congenitally diseased, living lives, as Thoreau suggested, of quiet desperation, occasionally, maybe, experiencing peace. Desire gets life out of balance, out of round. The question is, how long shall I keep pretending that all is well? It's okay. Really, I'm fine. Sigmund Freud, and I know he's not that popular, but he was right when he spoke about a fire without a focus that burns at the center of our lives and pushes us out in a relentless, unquenchable pursuit of pleasure. Doris Lessing is right. She speaks of a certain voltage within us, 1,000 volts of energy for sex and love and hatred and art and politics. James Hillman is right. A blue fire burns within us, and we can be so haunted and obsessed by demons that are not our nature. Both women's and men's groups are right. They speak of a certain wild energy we need to understand more fully. Women's groups talk about the importance of running with wolves. And men's groups talk about wild men's journeys and having fire in one's belly. Let's get this right. Desire can be good. Soren Kierkegaard was right. Purity of heart is to will one thing. What if there's a simple, single desire in us, pretty much like water for a fish, a simple desire in us that should be pretty straightforward, but you know, it's kind of easy to get confused and tangled and out of round and ride the wrong camel. Spirituality is ultimately about what we do with our tangled desires. Good spirituality is however we process our longings, coming to regard them as substitutes for our holy longings and thirst that is built into us. I'm going to repeat that. Good spirituality is however we process our longings, coming to regard them as substitutes for our holy longings and our holy thirst that are built into us. How we get thirsty, how we cross the threshold from cave to sunlight, from fish on camel to fish in water, that is our spirituality. St. Augustine, you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. Spirituality is then, therefore, coming to recognition of our thirst, of working it through so that our desires are simple, simple. So Ms. Pak over there in Seoul, like us in this room, we can experience being a fish in the wrong medium, and this is a first step. Once again, Dr. Newton's first law of motion, things at rest tend to stay at rest, and things at motion tend to stay in motion unless operated upon by an external force. And so Mr. Hafiz, the fish, wakes up, suddenly thirsty. That is half the battle. Because I think that Mr. Hafiz's fish has come to the realization, the awareness that the water in which it has swum, is that right, swum, has found the water lacking, messed up, polluted, full of should-like contaminants. And this is where Baptist preacher that I am, I'm going to usually ask us to do something hard. Kierkegaard called it the leap of faith. Nobody hasn't leaped in here yet, have you? Nobody hasn't leaped in here yet, have you? We've all leapt from what we knew or know to something that we did not know. We've all been to the threshold. We've all taken that job in faith. We all married that person. We all trusted someone. We all trusted our guts. What is leaping in faith but a regular spiritual discipline? It's like pull-ups and push-ups. This leaping is always going to be hard, but my fellow Popeyes is always going to taste like spinach. But isn't it the very thing we need? I have faith in leaping. I have faith in leaping. I have faith in the kind of God that so processes this world that the nets we need appear only if we leap. The wings we grow, the wings we need grow only after we jump. The shadows disappear as we cross the cave's threshold. The leap will ask us hard things. Use a passport. Change addresses. Change a life. Teach someone to read. Be a monkey wrench in somebody's cultural machinery. Stop playing the game. Love again. Marianne Williamson, whom I think many of you know, writes, and I'm going to say these words. If you know them, you can sing or say them along with me. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant and gorgeous and talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You're a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We're all meant to shine as children do. We're born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. And it's not just in some of us. It is in everyone. And I love this part. As we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. Is anybody ever enriched by playing small? Remaining on the threshold, their leaping muscles untested? Williamson's amazing statement is that when we practice leaving the camel's back, we model for others the holy permission to do the same. Wow. That's a perfect way for a UU congregation to think of itself as evangelistic. Modeling your liberation helps other people get liberated. Just practicing your liberation liberates others. So where do you see fish on camels' backs? Where do you see people in bondage? Bondage doesn't have to be bars and ropes. It could be economic. It could be gender. It could be political, cultural, religious. People can get their hands tied by all kinds of materials. But can we model the permission for them to be free? Oh, what a concept. The poet David White, and that's spelled with a Y, David White writes, "You're not a troubled guest on this earth. You're not an accident amidst other accidents. What urgency calls you to your one true love? What shape awaits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against a future sky? Is it waiting in the fertile sea, in the trees beyond the house, in the life you can imagine for yourself, in the open and lovely white page on the writing desk?" This I believe time. This is why we're here, time, for me. We are wonders, folks. We are wonders. We are conscious stardust. We've arrived here in magic. We are fired into life with a passion that comes from eternity, which, before we melt back again into eternity, induces in us great love, inspires heroic deeds, pilgrim journeys, the righting of unbelievable wrongs, and other stupendous imitations of the divine. This is a life that matters. We are significant and alive in significant times. We can pay great attention to greatness. What are you thirsty for? What camel's back do we need to leap from? Be thirsty. Becoming thirsty is a gift, and it's a practice. Who's thirsty?